Thanks for listening to this episode of PageCast, brought to you by Jonathan Ball Publishers. Today's episode features Dr. Roy Haverman. Dr. Haverman is the CEO of Kruthum, previously IntelliDex, a research and advisory firm with offices in Johannesburg, London, and Boston, among a series of other very impressive titles and experience. He joins us on PageCast to chat about his book, How to Fix or Unfuck a Country. After state capture, South Africa is not in a good place. The system is down, but how do we reboot it? We are not the first country to find itself in a difficult spot. China, India, South Korea, Vietnam, and many others have gone from being economic basket cases to powerhouses, lifting millions out of poverty. So how can we pick ourselves up and fix things? In this book, Roy Haverman argues that right now we need to focus on six basic E's: Eskom, education, environment, exports, ethics, and equality. In this episode, Roy is in conversation with communications expert at Allen Gray, Twangi Kalula. Enjoy.
You're listening to PageCast. I'm Twangi Kalula. I'm a recovering journalist who works in the media and communications, and I'm also a South African citizen. And I think more importantly, I'm a citizen who is growing increasingly concerned with the state of our economy and our future prospects, which is why it's a pleasure to be joined today by Dr. Roy Haverman, who's the author of a brand new book. It's called How to Fix or Unfuck a Country, Six Things to Reboot South Africa. So I've known Roy for a few years, and I've always known that he's incredibly smart, and he did something very boring, but quite important for the way that the world needs to run and the country needs to run. But I had no idea that he was working on a book that would actually make economics sound relatable and make reading about it feel like a good use of my time. And I think particularly now when we see a lot of election posters up and we're hearing a lot of promises from different political parties, it just feels so apt. How did you end up finding your way into economics, first of all, Roy, this weird profession that is really important?
Oh, good. Yeah, thanks very much, Twangi. Yes, economics kind of found me. I think you kind of feel that economics is a bit like a sorting hat when you go to university and suddenly you discover this incredible subject that asks exactly those questions. I mean, why are some people incredibly poor? Why are some people very rich? Why do some countries do well? Why do other countries not do well? How do we understand this? And how can we be one of the countries that are successful, or one of the countries that are not successful? Or how can we make our country better, reduce inequality, et cetera? I mean, these are all the questions that economics grapples with. And I was drawn to it from a very young age.
And I think we live in a very interesting country in that regard, because I think there are so many different structural issues at play at different levels. So I'm sure that the questions continue and the answers are never clear. How did you decide to take this passion of yours, which you've obviously turned into a career, and then decide to make it into a book that ordinary people could kind of understand and grapple with some of the big ideas that you kind of touch on?
Well, I mean, I think exactly as you said in your introduction, you're very concerned about where the country's going and have, I guess, some worries about what the future might bring. And similarly to me, I was quite concerned, and I was very fortunate to work at the center of government and see how it all works. And I think one of the things that I realized was that we weren't communicating what needs to be done clearly and concisely and to a general audience. And economists are very, very well known for not communicating clearly. We use these big words like structural reform, which really is unhelpful because it actually means something quite simple, like we need more electricity, or we need, you know, ports that goods can go through, etc. And so I really decided I wanted to get this out of me and articulate it very clearly. So that was the idea.
So it's going to be pre-reading for all your dinner parties so that you don't have to try and break it down for your friends there, I assume.
Well, I mean, funny you say that, but I mean, everybody asks, oh, you're an economist. So like, what will you do to fix the country? I was like, no, I've written a book. Don't ask me at dinner parties. Let's talk about other stuff at dinner parties. Read my book. And
what I find quite fascinating and something that I've been thinking about quite a bit is that, you know, we kind of live in a world where we like things to be relatively black and white and clear. We like definitive answers. We want to know what the future holds. And I guess your book is offering, I guess, some ideas on how we can deal with the issues. But you're doing it in a way that kind of takes into account what's happening today, knowing that tomorrow could be very, very uncertain. But there are clear things that have worked through history. When it comes to economics, why is it so useful to go back and look at other locations and things that have happened historically?
Yeah, I mean, this has been sort of the big change in economics over the last decade or so, which is a much more historical focus that the discipline has gone through, which I strongly support. And the other thing, like you say, is very much about, I think that we in this country sort of suffer from a very inward-looking approach to our problems. And we don't sometimes just read up about what other countries who have been in similar situations have done and how they've sometimes been successful and how they've sometimes not been successful. So, I mean, one of the big things the book tries to do is to do a sort of a comparison and to have a look at other countries and to identify what lessons we can draw from other countries for our own situation. And so in that way, it's a very outward-looking book.
Great. And then in terms of bringing it back home, I mean, oddly enough, I spent a lot of time staring at your dedication page right up front. I think it was quite profound. You dedicated the book to the millions of South Africans without jobs. And I thought that that spoke volumes. You know, it's just usually to my cat, Theodora, and my grandmother, you know, who inspired me to write. But can you tell me more about that? Because it seems to be at the heart of what the book is really trying to address, is the fact that we've got a lot of people who have no work and have no means to, you know, afford themselves all the things that were promised, you know, kind of 30 years ago as part of our new democracy.
Yes, I mean, I hope that in some way that this, if this creates one job, I think it would be a success. But I hope that the ideas that I put in the book help us move policy along and help bring millions of people out of poverty. And that, as I argue in the book, one of the best ways of bringing people out of poverty is to give them jobs and to have an economy that produces jobs for people. I do quote the numbers in terms of how many people have been lifted out of poverty in China and in India and in Vietnam from similar policies to what I talk about in the book. And I think that if we did similar things here, we could also lift millions of people out of poverty and give millions of people jobs.
I've spent a lot of time recently on that note, chatting to politicians and, you know, their kind of staff members who are on the ground and trying to engage with communities and really understand some of the challenges we face. And one of the things that a lot of them have mentioned is how difficult it has been to communicate with young people who are kind of despondent about what has happened. And I recently chatted to someone who said, you know, it's the lack of imagination around offering ideas that are compelling. And I, as I was thinking about that, I wondered, the ideas in your book are clear, they're simple, and you don't kind of play down the fact that by implementing any kind of intervention, there are complex things at play and you've got to balance, you know, quite a few things. But I was just wondering, after having spent so much time working in the public service and then moving to the private sector and seeing all the challenges, why do you think there is such an obstacle in terms of just implementing some simple interventions that seem so obvious?
Yeah, I mean, the last chapter grapples with this exact question. You know, it really asks, you know, all the things in the book are actually some version of government policy. I have one idea which is controversial in government, but is not necessarily out of bounds in terms of what the current administration would like to achieve. Famously, Energy White Paper came out in 1998, and it just has not been implemented. And as a result, you know, we've had load shedding. And then I look at what other countries have done to actually get things through the system. And I highlight that what other countries have done is created a very small team of very focused people that can just get this done, sort of allocating very clear lines of accountability, very senior people, very well connected, and making them run with it and not leaving it to this great amorphous bureaucracy that will magically achieve things. You know, you really need a small driving team, often at the top, around the president, driving these changes. And that's actually what I recommend.
It's a great opportunity to go into the first E. So the book is basically focused on those six things that you suggest to reboot South Africa. They all begin with E's. And the most obvious one is Eskom. And when you talk about kind of just this kind of feeling that we look into the future and hope things will fix themselves, I remember describing it to someone of like, we're kicking the proverbial can down the road and it's finally found one of those marvelous potholes that we have all over our roads. Mm-hmm. And we've kind of, you know, been in trouble. Last year was the worst year for the country in terms of load shedding. It's beginning to really impact our economy in a real intangible way. And you, despite all of that, you seem quite optimistic that this is a problem that can be solved. Can you tell us a little bit more about Eskom and how you think about fixing the mess that we're in?
Right. So, I mean, other countries, same mess. So I highlight China, who have series of load shedding. You don't hear very much about it. Their load shedding is actually good load shedding, I guess, is that their biggest period of load shedding was just after the Asian crisis, and they didn't expect the world economy to rebound quite as quickly as it did. So they didn't build as much electricity as they needed to. And so they had major power blackouts throughout the country. Colombia had a power crisis for other reasons related to the dams. And then Greece has had power problems. So you look at all these different countries and you go, okay, what did they do? And what they did is they allowed for private sector generation to come on, more and more private sector generation to come on. What you do there is you shift the risk, the demand risk, the planning risk from the center state into the private sector. And you allow some of the planning function and the sort of the technological function there. That's the generation component of it. Transmission, which is getting the power from the power stations to the municipality, that is very difficult to take out of state hands. And I don't think it should be taken out of state hands. It's a natural monopoly. It's what we call a public good in economics. And so it should be under some version of state control. So I don't think that should at all, there should be any role for the private sector there, or a very limited role. And then there's the distribution component, which is at the point where it comes from the transmission into households, where there are problems in South Africa. But all I really talk about is the generation component. And I look around what other countries like China and Colombia and Greece, and there are many countries that have done this, and that's to allow more private sector participation in generation. Of course, we're doing a version of that through the IPPs, but it's been very slow and there've been lots of problems with it. And so really what I'm saying is we need to really accelerate on that.
It was actually quite interesting to read about stories, in those countries that face similar issues. I think we've been living with it for so long and we assume that it's such a South African thing. But it is comforting to know that it can be overcome. And one of the things you highlight in the book is the fact that public and private partnerships are essential pretty much to all of the kind of things that we need to get done. But there seems to be this notion at such a basic level that the private sector is good and the public sector is bad. And they seem to be quite, weary of each other. Can you talk to me a little bit about that and what the cost is of that, on our society?
I didn't say this quite that way in the book, but I have another presentation that I've been presenting on things. And I say that, what the kids of today have taught us is there are no binaries. There's not either that the world is run as the private by the private sector or that the world is run by the state. Everything is some combination of the state and the private sector. You'd be surprised how important the state is, and even like the ability for you to build your own house. There's regulations, right? But it's your house. But it's within a regulatory framework. And all the way to the other end, there are things that are much better done by the state than done by the private sector. And I think what has happened a little bit ideologically is people have been caught in this binary world where you have to, some people think the private sector is all good and there should be no state involvement in the economy. And other people take the opposite view, depending on their ideological background. And I actually talk about a really interesting guy in China who was actually against a lot of the Chinese reforms in the Communist Party. And he described the idea as a birdcage where the state provides like the framework, which is the cage, and the private sector is the bird. And if you don't have a cage, then the bird, which is like the private sector, will fly away and go crazy and you'll have financial crises and collapse of, capitalism, which I guess Marxists would say. But if the cage is too small, then the bird suffocates and dies and can't flourish. So it's actually about getting the size of the state and the framework within which the state operates to be roughly the right size. And that's kind of, it's not my own insight, but it's, I guess, what the book's trying to say.
One of the areas where the state plays such an important role is actually your second E, which is education. And we've kind of created this South African environment where there are two types of education. You know, there are a handful of really, really good public schools, but the private sector has kind of jumped into fill a vacuum, but that has obviously broadened inequality in that system. And as I was reading your book and reading what had been done in countries like Kenya, I was thinking education is such an obvious one. I mean, it's something that everyone kind of says is important and agrees upon quite universally. And I thought your solutions were simple and practical. But I was left wondering, what about all the people who have been left behind? And I just wanted to kind of pick your brain a little bit about, you know, we looked at COVID and all those kids who didn't attend school for those long periods of time. We look at kids who completely missed the boat and are kind of hanging around, and they're much older and you know, perhaps not able to go back to school. How do we kind of solve this big backlog? And are we going to be paying for it in a generation or so?
I think we're definitely going to be paying for the generation or so. I mean, I can see lots of clever academics writing papers about the impact of children who, you know, who were born in a particular year and how their life chances have been, you know, changed significantly. You know, I know some of the education departments like the Western Cape has tried really hard to get those children back into the system and to get them to catch up. Other than trying to get somehow catch up, I really am worried, I think, about those COVID children. It's I can't imagine trying to teach 10-year-olds online. I mean, it must be almost impossible. I struggle to learn things online. You know, I wonder how kids do. And so I do worry about the backlog. I think we need to make sure that we somehow catch those children up.
And then in terms of the education as it stands, I mean, you had some practical ideas of improving the reach of schools that are really working around well. Can you share some of the other ideas that you kind of had to kind of just improve education more broadly, and then also the benefits of getting it right?
Yeah, so some of the benefits are, I mean, I think it's pretty obvious. I mean, I think that you know, when you think of your life chances, I went to a government school, and I think I went to an excellent government school. I happened to be in a government school with some very famous people, constitutional court judges, etc. And my life chances were substantially improved by going to such a great government school, which suggests that government schools can get it right if the system's right. But to the ideas, I mean, the really, it's a sad thing, but also a great lesson, is that one of the big, great things that we've done as a country is introduce school feeding schemes. So children get food during the course of the day if they're in poor schools. And there have been some really interesting studies about what happens when you introduce school feeding into the system. And learning outcomes improve significantly in the schools where you introduce school feeding schemes. Some other examples have been, actually there was a trial where there was both breakfast and lunch provided to children, and in those schools learning outcomes also improved. You know, that's sort of the reality of this country, is that children arrive at school hungry and unable to function because they're hungry. Feeding them makes a big difference. So one idea. The other one is to really drive a sort of a back to basics approach and to drum reading as a key intervention, because children are coming out of the system unable to read. My colleague and friend who was a great commentator on the book, Nick Spohr, has, you know, really drives reading as the number one outcome. How do we get school books into classrooms? How do we have a technology-based approach to driving reading behavior? And I use the example of Kenya, where the teachers actually have tablets, and they get scripts, and they basically follow the script in class. It's a really interesting e-learning intervention that's not you put a bunch of kids in a room with a TV. It's actually you give the technology to the teacher, and then you just drive this reading thing. And then my last suggestion, which is the controversial one, is to make it easier for really hardworking, bright kids to go to the best schools.
I absolutely agree with that. And I think, like Nick, I'm incredibly passionate about reading. And I guess we're on the Jonathan Ball PageCast podcast because of that reason. But I did chat to a teacher a few months ago who runs interventions in her class to get kids by the time that they're in grade one to be able to read and read with comprehension. And I think that's the missing bit, is that I think we kind of look at the numbers of kids who matriculate, but we don't find out whether they can understand what they're reading and then go on to, you know, think further and apply it. And we don't spend a lot of time, you know, figuring out if their numeracy skills have actually pulled through. And it reminds me of something that Rudi Tsabi once said, where she was just like, it feels sometimes that, you know, we're trying to create an education system that produces dumb kids, and if the dumber the better, you know, was kind of her theory about it. And I was just wanting your view on how you think we got it so wrong, because it felt like it was one of the ones we should have got right very early on.
There factions in education, and I am of the view, which is a faction, that the quintile system has been a failure. The quintile system works on the prerogative, on the idea that schools in poor areas should get more money, and schools in rich areas get less money, and there's a quintile system, and they divide it up. It misses a trick, which is that means that if a child wants to go to school in a rich area, and which are typically Model C, formerly white schools, there is no subsidy that follows them. They kind of, by the way the system is designed, the free schools are all traditionally formerly black schools, often in townships. And these are schools that were set up to fail by the apartheid regime, and have not managed to get themselves right since the fall of apartheid. But somehow the incentive structure doesn't allow these children to actually move to schools and better resourced schools and take their subsidy with them. And we all know about children that come from townships, and, you know, with their mothers do everything to get them into good schools, and they save up and they put, you know, they transport them, and the costs are extraordinary. And you can just see how the life trajectory of these children have been changed by their parents that spend so much money getting them into good schools. And I'm wondering, why does the system perpetuate this? And so one of the things I suggest is actually we really need to relook at the quintile system.
I think one of the things I loved about that, just to wrap that point up, is I kind of took away the fact that at the moment, we kind of celebrate success stories where a child has been exceptional and achieved something against the odds. But to truly move the needle, you've highlighted that, you know, we need to think broadly and, you know, catch a lot more kids, so that it's not one or two kids in a community that kind of make it, but that each kid has a much better chance. Which brings us to our third E, which is the environment. Now, of course, it is quite a controversial one, I think, particularly when you start talking about growth. And I'm reminded of a conversation I had where someone said economists will just tell you to grow things at all costs with no regard for climate change. What are your views on this? Because I thought they were quite balanced.
I mean, my view is that, you know, I'm still relatively young. I do think that we need to be able to grow in 50 years' time. And, you know, one hopes that in 50 years' time, the world wouldn't have warmed up to a point where it's impossible for us to grow the economy. And so I make the point in the book that it's really about thinking about the long term. And if we want a long-term sustainable growth path, we have to do something about climate change. We have to think a little bit ahead, and we have to take into account interventions that will reduce the amount of carbon going into the economy, and we have to do something about climate change. And that's thinking as sort of an economist, not necessarily as a environmentalist. It makes a lot of sense to me to think about the long term in this regard. And, you know, I make the point that, you know, it's really hurting South Africa. There is a change in how I use the example of an apple, in a thesis by a guy called Anton Cartwright, about how we will no longer be able to produce apples in the valleys of Ceres, but we'll probably have to move them higher up the mountains. That means that we'll lose lots and lots of jobs, because it'll just become more and more expensive to just make an apple, which is only one example of, you know, hundreds of different agricultural goods that will be affected by climate change. Of course, on the other hand, there are lots of people in the coal industry, in the electricity industry, and we do need to find ways of protecting their livelihoods or slowly transitioning them out of one industry into another. But on average, I am in favor of taking action against climate change.
I think something like climate change highlights one of the challenges that I perhaps is a thread throughout the book, is that because a lot of our problems in the country are urgent, we tend to kind of focus on short-term solutions, you know, and you never kind of heal the actual problem. You kind of just put a Band-Aid over it. And a lot of the countries that have managed to successfully overcome some of the challenges we face think very long-term. Can you tell us a little bit about that and why you think it is? You know, we've seen interventions in China, for example, that seem like they're aimed to improve things a generation, you know, ahead, for example.
Absolutely. I mean, China is a great example of that thinks generationally. So it thinks not where they want to be this generation, but where they want to be in two generations or three generations. And I don't get the sense that we think like that. And in actual fact, we're sort of shooting ourselves in the foot. So we have an electricity crisis. The long-term solution is to open up the markets and allow for generation. But we get so caught up in trying to, you know, fix load shedding tomorrow or this year or this month, that we don't actually take the interventions to fix load shedding at a structural level. And so, yeah, I completely agree with you. We do need to start thinking generationally about the future of the country.
One of the things I really enjoyed about your book is that it made economics so relatable. And I think it's one of those things that we all engage with until we start our careers, I guess, and learn about things such as inflation and how interest rates can really impact your livelihood. So it makes it very real. But what I loved in the foreword is that former finance minister Tito Mboweni kind of talked about the fact that he got tired of chatting to economists and having these circular conversations, and he invited a farmer over to kind of talk about how he experiences some of the economic challenges we're facing. And the nicest part of that was that he said, "I need ports that work so that I can sell my produce to the rest of the world." It's no secret that our ports have faced numerous challenges. And it seems to have been something that happened quite slowly. And now we're really, really feeling the impact of it. And it feels overwhelming in terms of turning it around. But can you tell us a little bit about what the real challenges are and some of the success stories that kind of inspired the interventions you're thinking about?
Yeah, so it's a pretty simple. I mean, the exports chapter, oddly, took me very quickly to write. It's, in my view, there are much more complex interventions we need to do to raise exports, and economists will go on and on about J-curves and all this industrial policy. Also, right now, right here, the issue for us is that if you produce something and you want to export it, you can't get it out. And that's because the ports have seized up. What we've seen other countries have done, and I use the example of China, who's actually done it quite recently, is introduce concessioning, so allow these huge international companies that run ports around the world to run the ports, and they obviously follow a sort of a competitive process to appoint them. Other countries have done the same, not least in Mozambique, where the ports there are increasingly concessioned. Beira is, for example, run by a partnership between a Mozambican public company and the Quinalda Group, which is an international company that specializes in maritime logistics. And that's really what I suggest we must accelerate. Interesting enough, transit is trying, but there have been lots of problems. And they've kind of, there was a near success in Durban, but at the Itiquini port, but it hasn't come off the ground.
I mean, it highlights another theme that you kind of have threaded through all the points, which is kind of the level of red tape and bureaucracy that we face. And it's a very difficult thing to overcome. How have countries similar to us kind of managed to cut that kind of problem and make policy reform and all of those things much easier?
Yeah, so China, again, maybe it's the disadvantage of having a very open consultative democracy sometimes is sometimes things need to be done. And, you know, I think sometimes we get caught up in over-consultation or processes, and we also believe that there are solutions that don't have trade-offs. I think one of the first things one learns in Economics 101 is that economics is all about trade-offs. And there are trade-offs. You have to admit that there are trade-offs. If we concession the ports, there will be impacts on some of the jobs of people that currently work in the ports. These are things you have to accept. I think sometimes other countries accept those things and move on. We muddle and hope for the best.
And we're kind of like 3 decades, I guess, into our democracy, and we had these huge dreams of how things were going to be. And I think we kind of structured the democracy so that people would all feel represented and be able to be consulted and kind of build this country together. And that has led to kind of your fifth E, which is pressing, and it's equality. And despite the fact that, you know, we have kind of been structured so that there is equality in terms of inputs and points of view, it hasn't happened. Why is equality so pressing for you? A lot of people look at the rest of the things and think that there are things that need to be done immediately, but this is really one of the ones that you're passionate about.
Yeah, and this was the most difficult chapter to write. And it goes, and I went back to a very old idea in economics, and it's not always the most fashionable one, which is this idea of the Kuznets curve, which is that sometimes growth does create inequality. In many countries it has. I certainly think it has in this country. So the great irony, as you kind of say, one of the great problem of this country is that during our best boom years, we've often seen inequality rising. And I talk a little bit about how that reflects the fact that skills are very inequally distributed in this country. And so when growth arrives, it's often those with skills that can take up the opportunities first. And then those without skills can slowly accumulate those skills and be brought into the economy. And this is sort of at the heart of a lot of the debates about growth, which a lot of people say, no, we shouldn't grow because it does this. I respectfully disagree. I think that you must be completely clear-sighted about the fact that there can be these consequences, and how we've seen other countries deal with it is to spend lots and lots of money trying to improve the lives of the less well-off at the bottom of the income pyramid, through a variety of things, through education, to give them the skills that they can use in a modern economy, through social grants, which we do quite well, et cetera, et cetera. But not to be unaware that this is a problem, right? And I think especially in this country.
It's a difficult one to grapple with, and it'll remain a threat, I guess. And then, I mean, the numbers speak for themselves. In the beginning of the book, you talk to how many people are unemployed. And when you start to kind of try and visualize and truly imagine what that means, you have to accept that as a country, you know, we can't move forward without addressing those issues. And one of the things that I'm so worried that anyone listening is going to think is that this sounds really idealistic, which brings me to your sixth kind of emergency point, which is having an ethical and effective state. Now, we know corruption has been a huge problem for us. It's not unique to us in South Africa. I think sometimes we tend to think that it doesn't happen in other parts of the world. But, you know, we've kind of looked at the fact that, you know, we face state capture. We've had the Zondo Commission. But I think it's bigger than that. What do you think got us to a point where we face some of these ethical kind of challenges at a state level? And how do we kind of shift that around, you know?
No, absolutely. I mean, I think that's been the greatest disappointment. And I think that, and I sort of try and make the point that we have kind of often thought that it's a government thing, that people in government are often corrupt. I mean, there obviously are people in government that are corrupt. But we've had Steinhoff, and we've had VBS, which was actually initiated. The auditors were the most corrupt, it seemed, in that situation. And so, you know, it's not really a government versus private sector thing. I mean, some of the most corrupt people have been white people. Some of the least corrupt people have been black people. It's no longer a racial thing, or is this deep ethical problem in the country at the moment. And I look at sort of some of the things that other countries have done. I was really taken by a book called Corruptible by Brian Klass, who talks about the need for you to be able to have easy to understand rules about corruption and then to punish corruption. And he also makes the point that there's a lot to be said for the old saying that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. But that sometimes powerful people that are bad are often drawn like moths to a flame into very powerful positions and become corrupt. So you also have to stop them there. But it is, I think, the big problem, obviously, for all of us.
Just something to grapple with, you know. I also kind of think about it a lot. And I remember someone once telling me that you must remember that at the end of every government official who's willing to accept a bribe, there's someone in the private sector willing to pay it. And our politicians don't just appear. I think we kind of have this kind of us and them narrative, but they live in our communities and they are relatives and friends, you know, as well. And it's the same thing with the business sector. So I think it is something that when people kind of talk about what can we actually do, I think it's for us to think about how we behave in our communities, how ethical we are in our own capacity. I think it's something that can creep into society. And I think in your book, you kind of talk about how there has to be a real big shift in thinking about ethics and you know, to really make a difference in that regard. And then as I was reading it, I thought the one E that was missing was entrepreneurship, because we kind of have had this huge narrative of start small businesses, get things done. But I think what your book does beautifully is kind of say that these simple things, these six things that you mentioned, it's not a catch-all for all our problems, but it's the foundation for being able to get things like entrepreneurship right. What are some of the other kind of, they don't have to be E's, I guess, but what are some of the kind of the other kind of things you thought of as you're kind of trying to narrow down your list to this kind of group of six things that were the, like, emergency priorities?
The big one I've missed, and if I could do my life again, partly because books take a long time. And so what was a crisis when I started the book was Eskom, is less of a crisis now. To me, the big one is water. I really think that we are grappling with a water crisis on a range of different levels. A lot of it goes back to the idea of a state that's unable to just make sure the pipes are fixed and the water supply works. But a lot of it's climate related, that they're changing rainfall patterns, etc. So water would be definitely one of them. I agree with you on entrepreneurship, but I don't think that the state can do all that much about entrepreneurship. I think the state can provide electricity, so when entrepreneurs try and run their shops, then there will be power to help them. But I'm sort of just being facetious. But no, you can definitely do a lot about entrepreneurship.
Well, I mean, there's always a book too, so I'm sure that we can deal with the next six things too. And I think the big thing, I mean, to me, throughout all of it, is if you don't have energy as a steady supply, entrepreneurs can't start business. If you don't have people with just basic competent education, you know, the entrepreneurs don't have the support to run those businesses. The environment becomes key. Being able to sell your products becomes key. So I really do think that the six you've chosen do provide a great blueprint. And then I was thinking about the title of your book. So, of course, it's provocative, which a lot of books are. And I'm sure I read something a few weeks ago about how there's a boom in the top 10 bestsellers at airport bookstores, that if the word fuck is in your title, you're going to shift a few more copies. But it begs one question. If you're saying how to fix or unfuck a country, are we fucked? What's the question I kind of...
Well, very good question. I mean, I did workshop the title with a lot of people, and my 85-year-old mother-in-law said, I love it. and she said, oh, she thinks the country's fucked. I was like, oh, okay. in as many words. I actually conclude, I guess, from the chapter going around the world, that other people were more fucked than us. I mean, I cannot imagine what it must be like to be in the government in Vietnam in like just after the end of the war, and your country has been wiped out. Or Japan, where literally, you know, in 1945, there were whole cities that were just had been vaporized. There's no other way of putting it. Germany after the Second World War, Even China, which was a very, very poor country 20 years ago, you know, these are countries that were in a far worse state than us. I also use the example of India that ran out of money in 1991, or South Korea that was just a, you know, just a random place in the middle of nowhere with nothing, no minerals or anything, actually, and is now South Korea. We're not, I think, in as bad a situation as those countries have been, but we don't seem to be even taking grasp of what we have.
I think that's one of the highlights of your book for me, is that despite all of it, you are surprisingly optimistic about the potential of, you know, change. And I was expecting to have to like put a red wine IV in my arm as I read it. But you talk about some of the green shoots and some of the opportunities that you think are quite low hanging. And I think it would be a great place to end in terms of like, what are you most excited about? If we get some of these things right, what could the future be?
Yeah, I'm quite excited about electricity reform. I really think that we are going in the right direction. I mean, the book, as I said, it takes a while to get a book out. In the course of the book being in final editing, the National Transmission Company of South Africa has actually been formed at last. It'll only come into operation sometime next year. Now it's going to be in July, maybe in August. It's also not completely separated from Eskom yet because of a whole bunch of legal issues, blah, blah, blah. But we're going in the right direction. And I make the point at the end of the book that, you know, we could be living in a country like Venezuela where the policies are just batshit crazy, to excuse my language, since we are talking about my book that has a swear word in the title. I think I can swear during the podcast. Absolutely. You know, these crazy policy ideas. We're not those people. We actually have pretty good policy framework. We're just not implementing it. And that kind of goes to the 30-year thing that you started with. It's like, you know, we had great ideas. We had all this, and you know, but we're not doing anything. So, but hopefully we're getting in there. Hopefully we're getting there.
I think another comfort for me was the fact that, you know, one of the common criticisms in government is that it's all cronyism and there's no competence and skill. But you spent years working in National Treasury and in government. You've been an advisor in the presidency. And after reading your book, you prove that that's not true. In your experience, do you believe that we have the talent to do this? Can we pull this off?
Yes, I think we do. I certainly think we have the talent to do all of this stuff. I mean, like you said, I've been in government for a very long time, a bunch of really hardworking, committed people in government. I think we have the time to pull this off. I just think we need to think through just on electricity. I mean, I don't know how many ministers we have that are in charge of electricity. I mean, they're just those sorts of things. You know, simplify things. Simplify the processes. I can tell you war stories about how many committees you have to go through to get something done in government and how long it can take. And that's completely sort of an own goal, that we created a system that is just very slow. And that's, I think, maybe the big reform that's needed in the government, is to allow these people to, you know, these hardworking people to just get their jobs done.
This conversation is proof that problems can be overcome. We didn't have to deal with load shedding. We kind of, as South Africans, are very creative. We work around all of these issues. And the fact that you are able to write this book and actually grapple with the themes in it without fear is also such a wonderful thing about our democracy. So I think I walked away feeling more positive than negative and more hopeful than hopeless, which is, I guess, what you really tried to do. But I just really want to emphasize the fact that we've just kind of scratched the surface in terms of what these issues are, and some of the ideas you have around fixing them. And I think if you were listening to this, you would do yourself a huge disservice by thinking that you kind of have the book captured in a nutshell. I would strongly encourage you to go out and grab a copy. Roy's book, which is called How to Fix or Unfuck a Country, Six Things to Reboot South Africa, is available now wherever good books are sold. And I just wanted to say, Roy, thank you so much for writing this book. I hope you're working on your next manuscript. That's a question.
Not yet. Let me just get over this one.
But I'm sure you'll be doing a lot of talks. So I think if people have the opportunity to come and see you, they should visit the Jonathan Ball website and check out some of the event listings, and come to ask you their questions and grapple with the ideas. I think it is a wonderful book. If you're like me and you know nothing about economics, it breaks down complex ideas really simply. The solutions are simple, and you'll get a true appreciation of how the ideas that are required to fix our country really are things that are in reach. So again, Roy, thanks so much for joining me for this episode of PageCast. Until next time, I'm Twanji Kalula. This is PageCast. Thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to this episode of PageCast. We love hearing from you. So if you'd like to get in touch, please contact us at pagecastpodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, keep reading and listening.